Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. As you may know, a group of sexual assault survivors is pushing for the resignation of Manhattan District Attorney Cy Vance, saying he has shown a pattern of going easy on sexual predators when they happen to have money, power, and influence. Previously known, and notably, his office was lenient with Jeffrey Epstein over his registering as a sex offender, and also initially failed to prosecute Harvey Weinstein. The most recent example is a no-jail deal Vance's office struck with a gynecologist accused of sexually abusing at least 19 of his patients. One of those women was Evelyn Yang. Maybe you've heard this, the wife of presidential candidate Andrew Yang. She recently gave an interview to CNN describing the appointment where the Columbia University doctor, Robert Haddon, sexually assaulted her, she says. The tape here isn't explicit, but we warn you, it is upsetting.
I imagined myself as someone being, you know, like I would throw a chair at him and run out yelling bloody murder. It's not what happened. I was confused, and then I realized what was happening, and then I just kind of froze. Like a deer in headlights, just frozen. I knew it was happening. I remember trying to fix my eyes on a spot on the wall and just trying to avoid seeing his face as he was assaulting me. Was just waiting for it to be over.
Evelyn Yang on CNN. Here's a very short 9-second additional clip in which he says the prosecutor's lax charges felt like a second round of abuse.
The DA's office is meant to protect us, is meant to serve justice, and there was no justice here.
With me now is Marissa Hochstetter. She was also a former patient of Robert Haddon and founder of Reform the Sex Crimes Unit. She's now involved in leading the charge for Vance's resignation, claiming that money in politics influence who gets jail time and who doesn't. Welcome to WNYC. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
And before we get into the DA's involvement, can you tell the listeners, to the extent you want to describe it, your experience with Dr. Haddon? I know you've spoken publicly about it, and how you came to be connected with other women who went through the same ordeal?
Sure. I was a patient of Robert Haddon's from 2009 to 2012. I was pregnant during all but three of those visits. And his behavior became increasingly strange. And on the occasion of my 1-year postpartum visit, undoubtedly sexually assaulted me. The clip you played of Evelyn was very similar to my experience. I really froze, and he left the room, and I never went back to his office. I later reported the crime in the fall of 2015 to the Manhattan District Attorney, and again, like Evelyn, had a very similar experience in realizing that the assault was one thing, but the way that the District Attorney handled my allegation and that of dozens of women really was very offensive.
Let's go through the timeline a little bit. In June 2014, Haddon was indicted on charges involving six women, though there were many other women who came forward with their own stories after the statute of limitations had passed. Haddon got no jail time or prison time and was labeled as the lowest level of sex offender. What happened?
Well, I think we see a really clear pattern, as we've seen in many of the other cases you listed, of Vance's office not willing to seek justice when the perpetrator is a wealthy, connected white man, essentially, in these cases. it's interesting to note that the deputy chief of the sex crimes unit, who argued for the downgraded sex offender status for Jeffrey Epstein, was the same one who argued for that downgraded recommendation in the case against Haddon. We see campaign contributions from Haddon's attorney the same way and time that we did with Harvey Weinstein. So we see a really clear pattern of abuse of power.
You told BuzzFeed News, I believe, that you were originally satisfied with the outcome of the case in 2016. Do I have that right? And if so, what changed?
Well, very few people get to sit in court and see someone actually plead guilty to sexual assault. I mean, the numbers are incredibly small. And so even though I was lied to by the district attorney that my allegation was outside of the statute, I was able to sit in court and watch him plead guilty. They were not to crimes against me, but it provided an initial amount of sort of relief at the time. But in that same sentencing, when I heard the details of a plea agreement read out loud by the judge, the final part of the plea was the district attorney agreeing to not charge Haddon for any other crimes that they knew about. And that really wounded me, and I realized they were talking about me, and now I know many other women who had also come forward.
Listeners, I don't know if anybody wants to weigh in here. Maybe this is triggering an experience of your own, or if you would like to ask Marissa Hochstetter a question, former patient of Dr. Robert Haddon and founder now of Reform, the Sex Crimes Unit. She is involved in leading the charge for Manhattan DA Cy Vance's resignation, claiming that money and politics influence who gets jail time and who doesn't. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. How much is this, in your opinion, specific to the Manhattan DA's office, if true, this pattern of giving special treatment to people who are powerful or influential or have other kinds of relationships, including financial ones with him. Is it endemic to the way our criminal justice system works, in your view, or do we really have a Cy Vance problem here?
Well, I think it's both. I think the issues in Manhattan, because of the incredible concentration of wealth and social networks and power, it puts it in incredibly high relief. So you do see issues with prosecutors. It's maybe a fundamental flaw that they're elected, but at the same time, that is the only power that the public has to hold these people accountable. So Manhattan is not the largest jurisdiction, but it is certainly one of the most prominent. And I think the combination of politics and money has made it very challenged.
Vance's office would push back, I think, and say that his office has worked hard to fight against the two-tiered system we're talking about here. They would point to his office's efforts at reducing sentences for first-time low-level offenders. They declined to prosecute for marijuana possession back in 2018, for example. What, in your opinion, makes sex crimes a specific blind spot for the DA's office, which, again, they would deny? Or is it just that the area you happen to focus on?
Well, I think sex crimes presents a unique challenge for prosecutors. It is a challenging to take seriously, but we see time and again that men in power, and I would put Vance in that category, don't take sex crime seriously. So he can talk publicly and tout how much money he throws at the so-called rape kit backlog. It's a really antiquated way of talking about sexual assault. You know, recently there was a conversation about how he said he couldn't prosecute perpetrators when the victim was involuntarily intoxicated, that this was a loophole. So I think you see a rhetoric coming out of that office that is essentially dissuading victims from coming forward. So he touts himself as a progressive, but I don't think that the actions that we see align with those values.
Vance's donor roles didn't get much attention in the press until recent months, when news outlets took a closer look at old cases that had gained new relevance. Like in 2012, when Vance dropped the fraud case against the Trumps, and in that was Trump children, not Donald Trump, but involving sales of Trump Soho, I believe it was. And in 2015, when Vance decided not to pursue the sexual assault case against Weinstein, both cases were handled by defense lawyers who had contributed thousands of dollars to Vance. But he did an interview here on those two cases where he argued strenuously that campaign contributions had nothing to do with it. There was a lack of evidence to prove the cases, in his opinion, or the worst versions of the cases. And he made, legitimate prosecutorial judgments on people he may have been suspicious of, but where he felt he didn't have a case. Do you give any weight to that? Prosecutors have to make difficult decisions on what's winnable and what's not against people who are bad one way or another all the time.
So it's not just about winning. Prosecutors have to take risks. They have to be bold. And if you actually are going to do merit-based prosecution and believe survivors, think about how differently the Weinstein case and conversation would be now if Vance had proceeded with the case in 2015, even if he had lost. So sometimes they have to be willing to take risks, even if the result might not be a quote-unquote win. And I think that's something that we as a society have to be talking about when we say win. It's not just about putting people in jail. There's any number of options. But that involves talking with the victims who come forward. What do they want? And so in our case, we saw Vance's office misleading people about statutes of limitation, not telling people when the case was resolving in a plea. A number of really bad behaviors. So do I think that, you know, a couple $100 campaign contribution is what equaled the plea? No. But it is evidence of a system of bias and social network that surely, I mean, you can't argue that it's not easier to negotiate with someone that you've worked with before or you went to law school with before or who was on your transition team. So rather than deny bias, I think we need prosecutors to acknowledge that it exists and talk about what they're going to do to protect against it.
You mentioned a couple of times a charge that Vance did not tell you, and I think you just said did not tell others, that or misled you about whether the statute of limitations had expired on the crime you alleged. I imagine, I haven't seen a specific response to that on his part, but I imagine he would say, why would I ever do that? Why would I tell somebody who's been a victim or asserts that they've been a victim that the statute of limitations, something so factual, has run out when it actually hasn't?
So prosecutors see victims as work. And we have a fundamental flaw in the justice system that you come forward seeking help and you are seen as a threat to their winning record. So when the Times reported on our case last fall, there was a quote from the district attorney's office that they thought we essentially wouldn't have made good witnesses in trial because we were pregnant and couldn't see what the doctor was doing to us. I surely felt what he was doing, and that's something I will never forget. And so you see prosecutors looking for ways to not have to take a case forward. I think many people, until they actually encounter the justice system, are not aware of that sort of incentive that essentially they're only looking for a win. So I can't speak for him, but I know what happened to me when I went in to report the crime.
On the Haddon case in particular, Vance's team says it would have been difficult to convict Haddon had it gone to trial rather than a plea bargain because the defense was poking holes that I guess Vance must have found difficult to deal with in a trial context. In the women's credibility, and he further argues that the plea deal that they reached made sure that Haddon would not practice again, maybe the most important thing.
This is a person whose own defense attorney said he had over 30,000 patient visits in his over 20-year career at Columbia University. We now, you know, our attorney represents 47 women who've come forward. There are dozens of other women who've come forward to me who are not involved in our civil complaint. And so I just don't agree with that statement. And I think what we've seen now, the more that we learn about this, is a lack of willingness to take us seriously at the time to do a real investigation. They allowed Columbia's head of risk management to sit in on interviews with witnesses. Just the more that continues to be revealed about the case, I think the more we see that everyone really did the best they could to make it go away. And, you know, last Friday, you asked the mayor for his response to our calls for resignation. Thank you for doing that. And I thought the mayor's answer was really problematic in that he said this was just about Vance explaining himself. You know, he's had years to explain himself, and we continue to see essentially, you know, the quote you read that they were, we were not good witnesses. And I think we need to really think seriously about believing that a victim of a crime is a witness to their own assault. And what I said and what others have said matters. And when prosecutors don't take that seriously, we see outcomes like we did in this case.
Let's take a phone call. Jennifer in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hello, Jennifer.
Yes, good morning, Glenn, thank you for taking my call. I called in when you touched upon this issue in another program, and I just want to say this certainly is not specific to New York, though the wealth and power here is undeniable. I've experienced this throughout my life in my attempts to expose and report predatory and behavior and abuse of power when I lived in Miami, and it pertained to a psychologist. When I lived in Berlin, and it pertained to a professor and physician there, my experience has been that they are part of a network, a very colluding, conspiring network, where there is enormous focus on retaining power and position at any cost. I have faced enormous retaliation as a result. To this day, I still have to check in with government officials with respect to coming forward about issues. It has been an ordeal for anybody. It is an ordeal for anybody who has the courage and conviction to do this. But I've never regretted doing it. But we do have to recognize that it is institutional and systemic, and that in my experience, the women were just as culpable and just as protective of these transgressing men.
What women are you? What women are you referring to?
Pardon me?
What women are you referring to?
I'm referring to women who may be colleagues of these transgressing men, who, in my experience, have been some of the worst perpetrators in terms of protecting them.
In your opinion, Jennifer, as someone who's obviously thought about this a lot, and you're raising the issue of the institutional nature of it from city to city, country to country, are there any institutional reforms that you think would be particularly effective?
I'd like to believe, and I called in around the time the Me Too movement was starting. Obviously, after the Weinstein case came to the fore, I have not seen, in my opinion, a lot of demonstrable movement on this in ways that are really supportive of women who are coming forward. I think the awareness is there. I'd like to believe that the legislation is going to follow in terms of, again, whistleblower protection and such. But I still think that the cultural mores and such make it exceptionally difficult to tackle this.
Marissa, did you want to talk to Jennifer?
Yeah, well, I'd just like to comment that, or to respond that what she's touching on, I think, is this enormous gap we have between the Me Too movement and people saying, we believe you, support you, come forward, and then the reality of a victim's experience when they do come forward to law enforcement, with police, with district attorneys, and in my case, I would add, too, with Columbia University and medical institutions, the state medical board, those charged with really overseeing and disciplining doctors really have failed at their post because institutions are motivated to protect themselves first.
Jennifer, thank you very much for your call. Let's take another call with possibly one kind of systemic proposal. Susan in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I'm calling because I think when anybody has a gynecological exam, there should be a nurse in the room, especially if the
and by nurse you mean a female medical professional, right? A nurse, of course, could be a man or a woman as well.
Right. In other words, so that especially a woman. to be sure that nothing's going on.
Susan, thank you very much. And we have another caller that we won't have time to take, Marissa, who says Hasidic communities, and I can't confirm whether this is a fact or not, but the caller is saying Hasidic communities have female OBGYNs. I don't know if that's a matter of of practice in that community. But both are raising the issue of women in the room.
Sure, but I think we've learned, if we've learned anything from, say, the Nassar case where parents were in the room, Tyndall, I mean, in Haddon's case, there were people in the room, and then he would come back quickly. So I appreciate that perspective, and that seems like an easy answer, but this violence happens even when people are there. And so it is a patient's right to request a chaperone to be in there during examination. Yes, of course, but that's not a resolution, and I think that also makes victims feel that they have done something wrong by not having someone there.
And before we run out of time, on this question of institutional reforms of whatever kind, as the founder of Reform the Sex Crimes Unit, what exactly do you want reformed?
So we are really focused on accountability and transparency in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office, really focused on the 2021 race for that seat, and looking, really challenging the candidates to talk specifically about their proposed reform. So prosecutors' offices are essentially black boxes. They're opaque. We have very little information about how sex crimes, how they're being reported, how are they being acted on. So we're really looking for more information to then begin to have a conversation with experts and other stakeholders about the best way to move forward.
And lastly, how much support do you feel you have at this point for your call for DA Vance to resign? We heard the mayor wouldn't go there on Friday. Who is?
We've had enormous support from a number of assembly members, some city council members. I understand Speaker Johnson is willing to talk to some of his colleagues. I think it's really important that the political peers of Vance stand up to this behavior. You know, at some point, enough is enough, and they have to be bold and be willing to listen to people like me. I'm not the first person to come forward about this. I won't be the last. And at some point, they're basically going to be on the wrong side of history.
And D.A. Vance announced previously, I believe in 2018, that he would no longer take contributions from lawyers involved in cases that his office is working on after the Trump and Harvey Weinstein cases came to light. Do you feel that puts a lid on this for the future?
I don't. I think we still operate, you know, he's still operating within that social network. I think the report, which he commissioned from Columbia University to come to that conclusion, itself was a fundamental flaw, made no mention of a conflict of interest or our case, which was already public with Columbia. So I there's still big questions to ask, and that's a Band-Aid on a big problem.
Marissa Hochstetter, former patient of Dr. Robert Haddon, survivor and founder of Reform the Sex Crimes Unit. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.